There we go. Okay, so thank you very much for agreeing to chat to me today, Duncan. I believe you set up your organisation here at Windy in 1999.
Yes, that's right.
How did that come about? What was the needs you were trying to address with that?
The original idea for the project wasn't mine. It came from a combination of local authority officers and people within the local community who had the broad concept of what we took forward in 1999. But I suppose, truthfully, it was little more than an idea of what the area needed rather than how to turn it into a deliverable and sustainable entity. So, quite simply, I answered a job ad for somebody to take the idea and turn it into a business. And my background up to then was entirely in commercial business, and I'd set up or grown businesses for myself and for other people. So it was a short-term contract for me to look at the idea and see whether it was a viable idea and whether it was worth taking on to the next level, which clearly it was. So intrinsic to that was an asset transfer of the school building that used to be on the site that's now our centre here. And it was an old primary school from the Victorian era that the local authority owned and was at the end of its life, and I suppose elsewise would have been demolished or sold or whatever. So we asset transferred that from Aberdeenshire Council and more or less demolished it and rebuilt the purpose-built facility that we still have here, and it opened in 2003 in this building, although subsequently we've altered the building a number of times since. But the core concept of the Boindy Trust has really remained the same. And that's possibly a thing that we need to establish from the start, that there are two organisations based here, the Boindy Trust and the Bamshire Partnership, both of which are independent charities in their own right. But these days really operate as one organisation. So operationally, they're one organisation. Legally, they're not, because they started separately. And I suppose one day we'll unpick the legalities of turning them into one legal entity. But for the moment, that seems a pointless bit of work we don't need to do. Operationally, they work together. So the Boindy Trust is perhaps the simpler one, in that it has really one core purpose, but many, many subsidiary ones. And the core purpose was always to provide skills development training for local people who are unemployed and have some kind of special need. Special needs, quite a loose term, but I think broadly we would say it covered learning difficulty, physical disability, mental health problems, combination of. And really our role is to help those individuals find what they want to do in life, what their potential in life might be, and to remove the barriers for them achieving that. It's very, very rare that we would do a solo. Normally that individual would be interacting with a number of organisations, of which this is one, and part of a portfolio of help they need in order to get their goal in life. All of our training is delivered in a workplace environment, so we don't do much, very, very little anyway, of kind of classroom type activity. It's all in a workplace environment, and there's peer-to-peer learning as well as trained and paid staff who work as job coaches and training leaders. So that's been the same since day one. In order to work in a workplace environment, you need a business. And so we have a real business. It's a straightforward business. It's a restaurant and a garden centre and gift shops and some workshop areas as well, manufacturing workshop areas too. And the only thing that's changed since the original concept is just the size and the scale of it. There's nothing really else that's changed. We're still doing in many ways exactly what we did 20 years ago. But actually the people that we work with have changed quite a bit. We initially had quite an older group of people engaged with us on our skills development programs. I suppose typically people 50 plus, and that's changed completely. So now we have a very young group of people. I think because the activities that we do here tend to appeal more to younger people. We still have older ones. I have to say 50 plus doesn't sound particularly old to me these days, but it's predominantly, we have a lot, for example, of contact with the local schools, Bucky, Turriff and Banff, all of whom are looking at transitions for people coming from supported learning with them into the adult world, if you like. So we've got currently, I can't remember the exact figures, but roughly 50 people on skills development training programs with us. And that's a fairly consistent figure. It's been that for a while. What's different, I suppose, is, as I said, the age group and the complexity and level of training that we can provide. We've always had the concept of operating as what now I believe would be termed a social enterprise. We didn't know that term then. In other words, we're not dependent on grant funding. We earn our own income, and that gives us both sustainability and I suppose masters of our own destiny. I mean, very few people give you money in the format of a grant without some terms and conditions, or this is what we want you to do. And so we do use grant funding and have used grant funding for capital work, for example, building the training centre itself. But for revenue funding, it's always been what we earn. We don't have any grant funding at all and never have had. And to be honest, that's the way we like it. I've heard people say that commercial earned income is perhaps, you know, more precarious. I think that's completely wrong. I think grant funding is much more precarious than commercial earned income. But then I suppose you've got to remember that I come from a commercial background. So I didn't convert to social enterprise from a charity background. I converted to social enterprise from a straightforward high street business background. So that's what I'm comfortable with and know. Biggest change to the organisation came in 2005 when we, I'm putting in inverted commas, amalgamated with Banffshire Partnership. As I said, from a legal point of view, that hasn't happened, but operationally it did. A separate charity, it's no secret, Banffshire Partnership was struggling financially, but we saw the opportunity to co-locate in this building. And Banffshire Partnership's now very much another thriving social enterprise. It delivers, the biggest thing it delivers is transport services, which is mainly on the dial-a-bus model. So we run bus services from this very rural area through to the bigger towns such as Fraserburgh, Inverurie, Elgin, Huntly. But it's not really transport. So I think of transport as being the necessity to get from one place to another. And transport is not really what the dial-a-bus service is about. It's much more about addressing rural isolation, mental well-being, people being able to remain independent in their own homes. It's really social outcomes. It's not really a transport thing, although obviously people look at a bus service as being transport. But that's, transport is the output, not the outcome. We also have a little development arm, which is helping other organisations, other community-led economic, principally, developments, and helping communities do community plans, all that kind of thing. That's a commercial contract we have with Aberdeenshire Council, as incidentally is the dial-a-bus service. The transport contract, however, is a percentage contract. It's not an amount of money, so it pays for 70% of what the transport costs to provide, which clearly means we have to get the other 30% for somewhere else. The transport contract is a commercial contract in that Aberdeenshire Council doesn't provide its own in-house dial-a-ride service in Banffshire, because we do it instead. And broadly, they give us the money that they would have spent on running their own in-house service. So we don't really save them any money, but what we do is provide a much better and more extensive service for the same sum. So clearly, to make the books balance, we have to earn 30% from somewhere else. And for that, we have a commercial activity. We provide training services. We actually do teach people how to drive buses, but the main training that we provide is around first aid, manual handling, all the old health and safety type necessities that businesses have to have in their staff. And it is mainly larger businesses that we're selling that service to. So just to pick a customer at random, Baxter's Food just up the road, we can go along to them and say, you know, we'll make sure that you've got properly trained first aiders that requalify when they're supposed to requalify and have all their paperwork in order, and all you need to do is write us a check. So we're going along and helping them in that way, and of course we're earning an income for it. We also have a first aid events company, so that's our newest addition. It's about three, four years old. So we provide first aid cover using volunteers at events, and typically they are anything. Well, they can certainly be village shows and what have you, but typically they tend to be larger and probably sporting based. So things like new contract we picked up just a few months ago is for the motocross, right across the north. Motocross is extremely dangerous, so we can charge them lots of money. We had the contract for the kilt walks in Glasgow and Edinburgh and Dundee and Aberdeen, and I'm not sure there were any others. We did that for a while. We actually gave that up in order to take the motocross contract. So clearly we're operating way further afield than just Banffshire these days, and a lot of our bigger contracts do tend to be Glasgow, Edinburgh, that area. So those activities all, apart from just being very useful for the local community, they generate us some income, which largely balances the books for the other services that Banffshire Partnership provides. And then an example of where we would work together. I said that operationally Banffshire Partnership and Boindie Trust work together. So an example of that would be lunch clubs that we provide. We have a third partner, which is Age Concern, with that. And so we use the Banffshire Partnership's bus fleet to pick people up, and we bring them here to Boindie Visitor Centre, where the Boindie Trust staff make them their lunch, and then there's a lot of social interaction. People seem to prefer to being in this kind of garden centre, gift centre type environment, rather than locked away in a village hall somewhere, because they've got the general public there as well during their lunch club, and they can look around the shops and what have you. And Age Concern subsidise that. That's their input to the partnership. So again, collectively with Banffshire Partnership and Boindie Trust, we we have commercial contracts, or as the local authorities call them, service level agreements, and straightforward earned income. In other words, things that we invoice companies or individuals for. In terms of scale, I can't remember the exact figures, but I think I've got 56 paid staff if you take the two organisations together. We have about 300 Dial-A-Bus clients. I think we get somewhere like 60,000 visitors a year to the visitor centre here. I've already said I think we've got 50 people on skills development training. I can't tell you how many people we do training courses for in first aid and that. We have about 80 first aid volunteers. So that's, I'm just going through those numbers to give you a bit of an idea of scale. And that's really, it's as simple as that.
Sounds far from simple. Organising all of that. I'm really interested in this idea of your transition from the kind of commercial sector into social enterprise.
Me personally?
Yes.
Oh, right, okay.
Because, as you said, it's far more often that people perhaps have been working in the voluntary sector.
Absolutely.
Or the charity sector or even local local authorities and try and make the leap into social enterprise.
Yes.
So what made you give up a job in the commercial sector to do this?
Well, I didn't really do that. So I have only ever worked for one employer, which was the John Lewis Partnership, the department store chain. And I worked for them for 10 years. When did I join them? 1979 as a management trainee through to about 89, that was in London. And then very briefly for a couple of years I did work for them again at the end of the 90s in Aberdeen. But other than that, I've had my own businesses. So my wife and I sold our businesses. Well, basically we were given a good offer for the businesses we had in 1999, so we sold them and decided that, how can I put it, we were then in a position where we could really think what we would like to do in life, and I very much viewed this, well, as I said initially, I viewed it as a short term contract, just a few months before we most likely would have gone and bought another business and built that up and sold it on, which was what we'd kind of done. But I viewed this, what I now believe to be social enterprise, but certainly hadn't heard of the term then, as really adding another interest to business. I'm not saying I was bored with it, but so I don't know that very much has changed for me. What I've seen though is an opportunity to add another interest to my business life. So I've always been in retailing and catering, which is what I still do. But now it's got a lot of additional interest to it. So I really like the fact that we've got all of the kind of social benefits and seeing people develop. I've always enjoyed seeing people develop. And now I can see people develop at all kinds of levels. So, for example, we've got our people with special needs who we can see develop. But I'm probably thinking more in context of my 50 odd staff. That's a strange way of putting it. They're not all odd, but 50 plus staff, I should say. So I've got a number of relatively young staff who I've seen be able to take more responsibility, and that I really enjoy. So I'm not sure that I do actually see it as much of a change. I think the difference is obviously I don't own the business, it's a charity, but I do take a salary from it, so I'm still earning a living. I still treat it the same way as if it was my own business, in terms of being very committed to it, and I suppose I've got a relatively entrepreneurial nature, so I like to look at new things. What can we add to the portfolio? What can we... So it's really all the same stuff that I did for myself purely commercially, but with the added social benefits. So it's just really added something extra to my business life, and I think this is a massive, massive missed opportunity. I very rarely give talks or bother people with my opinion on things, but I have on occasion said that I do think that is a massive loss to Scotland, that we view social enterprise as being a way of converting charities to make them more financially sustainable. And I think that's perfectly fine and valid, but it can also be a way of converting businesses to have more than just commercial success. And I think there are probably... I certainly won't be unique as somebody who had worked purely commercially and kind of been there and done that and wanted to still do it. But it's always nice to add another string to your bow. So to be honest, I don't view it as having been a huge change. I'm still doing all the stuff that I was before, but just with some extra benefits. But I do seem to be relatively unusual in having converted from a purely commercial business background into social enterprise. And as I say, I think that's a lost opportunity.
Mm. Have you ever, you know, people sometimes talk about the challenges of squaring, you know, that social goals with the commercial ones. And sometimes people have told me that they feel like they've had to compromise on their social goals because of commercial imperatives. Have you ever experienced that kind of conflict or had to work through those kinds of issues?
There would be. I actually think it's more often the other way around. But that possibly comes with financial stability. So we're at the stage as a business after 20 years, and we're relatively successful, so that we can turn down a business opportunity because we don't think it's really in line with what we want to do as a charity. So for example, let me give you a small example. We made a conscious decision not to have an alcohol license for the restaurant. So I know that we could generate a small amount of extra profit by having one, but we view the social implications of it for some of the clients that we have as being a negative. So therefore, we knowingly, if you like, turn down a little bit of profit because that's the way we want to be. It's also the reason why in 20 years we've never served chips in our restaurant. So they're very simple examples. I absolutely agree there could be times when you would make compromises on your charitable side in order to make the books balance. And I don't really think that's a bad thing, because if it goes out of business, you're not going to do any charitable work. So the first, in order to do good for your local community, the first thing the entity has to do is survive. Fortunately, we're in the position where we don't really have to take those decisions anymore. It's much more likely to be the way I've described, where we will forego a potential business development because it's not really in line with what we want to do. And of course, most commonly, if you rely on grant funding, that will come along more often, because you'll have a grant funder that says, well, we can give you the money to survive, but actually we want you to do that, which is probably only 80% of what you've really wanted to do and feel your community needs. So that's when I said at the start about we've got through generating our own income, I believe we've got more freedom than if we were grant funded. So I think the circumstances you described could arise, and I think there might be times when it would be reasonable to take that kind of decision, but I can imagine it would be unpalatable to do it. But we tend, and that's why it's great that we've got a board of directors. So it's an oversimplification, but principally our board, which of course we have to have because we're a charity, board of volunteer directors. In fact, we have two, one for Banffshire Partnership and one for Boyne Trust. So principally my job as CEO is to make sure that the thing runs right and is viable commercially. And I suppose a key job they do is to make sure that we don't lose sight of our charitable aims. And so there definitely have been occasions where I've gone to the board and said, look, we could do this, but that would be the implications of it. What do you think? And I've never known them not go for the charitable aims over the financial gain. But then we're in a position where we can afford to make that choice, and other organisations might not be.
Mm. And so at first, was your kind of, has this commercial success and the independence that's given you, that's basically based on the restaurant, the garden centre and the gift shop, which is run as any other, you know, private enterprise, and that's generated enough profit to help you add back in?
Yes, although I should clarify that we don't have a trading arm as a charity. We don't need it, because everything we do, so if we ran the restaurant as a commercial entity to subsidise training in a sort of classroom environment, then the restaurant would need to be a trading arm of the charity. But we don't. So everything we do, be it running the restaurant, the garden centre or the gift shops, that's how we deliver our charitable aim. So people learn their skills. So my staff as job, so I don't employ people to lay a concrete path in the garden. I employ people to help the people who are on skills development training come up with the idea that we need a new path, and then understand how to use the cement mixer and order the stuff from the builders, merchants and what have you. So the whole running of the business is really just one giant training tool which develops not just new skills, but a whole sense of ownership and purpose and sense of self-worth and so on. And that does sometimes take a bit of understanding that it's not the model where we're doing a straightforward commercial activity in order to pay for something charitable. The commercial activity is in itself also the charitable activity. Mm-hmm. And I have had people who found that very, very difficult to understand when I've tried to explain it to them. I understand it because it just seems logical, but perhaps I'm just very bad at explaining.
No, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. Another thing I was interested in as you were describing the organisation was your ability to secure your commercial contracts for your first aid and so on. How did you build up the credibility that, you know, allows you to secure those contracts? Because I've heard that's going to be another area that small organisations find difficult, you know, for people to award them a contract and give them that chance to fulfil it and gain credibility and gain more over time.
There's no doubt that the hardest thing with any business... Well, that's not quite true. So I was going to say the hardest thing with any business is getting started and getting the credibility, which you basically get by delivering a really good service. And then you've got a portfolio of success you can show people, or even word of mouth of people doing that job for you, which is a lot of the business we get these days is via that means. But of course, it can work the other way, that you can get given a big grant and you start driving at 100 miles an hour first, and then the grant starts to run out, and you realise you haven't built that kind of. So I'm quite a conservative business person in that I like to build things gradually on very, very sound and secure bases. So we started off by getting relatively small contracts that we delivered very well. That was actually, I suppose, truthfully, a model I learned from the John Lewis Partnership, who I think are basically a very good organisation. And back in my day, when the Lewis family was still involved in it, it was illegal in-house to do any kind of advertising. It was against their business ethics. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. And it was all about, we'll build the business on reputation. And that's very much what we did. So we started off with going and getting a very small contract, doing it really well. And that's the key thing, is you need to do your business very, very well. So whether it's the restaurant, or whether it's delivering first aid training, or whether it's operating the bus fleet, or whether it's plants in the garden, we have very, very high standards. And quite simply, that's how I've always worked in business. And then gradually, you do build that reputation up. But it isn't easy. And it gets easier to an extent, but then if you're not careful, then you need to start making sure that you live up to your expectations. It's the same as restaurants that say they're the best, I don't know what, best steak restaurant in Aberdeenshire. You kind of need to make sure you are, because people are coming on and looking. So we need to maintain our standards. But all I can say is it gets easier. If you do the job really well, it gets much easier to sell and much easier to get contracts. There is a difference in that if you go down the route of, if I got the term right, PCS tender, for example, the sort of that kind of tendering, I'm not a huge fan of, because it's much more mechanical and based on facts and figures. So I'm much more used to direct selling, if you like, of just going and meeting somebody. But all I can say is, if you do whatever you do really, really well, it doesn't seem to me to be all that hard to get business. Mm-hmm. But yeah, maybe that's an oversimplification. I don't know.
I'm also interested in how you describe that. You know, suddenly you kind of heard you were a social enterprise, but that you've also been doing work in terms of helping the development of other kind of community-led economic initiatives.
Yes.
So it would seem to me, hearing that you maybe are part of there's maybe a kind of growing network of these organisations, or that there is some kind of bubbling up of different initiatives in the area.
Indeed.
Is that correct?
Oh, yes. So Aberdeenshire, the work that we do, what gets the acronym CED, Community Led Economic Development. So CED in Aberdeenshire is a commercial contract. So I think that, I don't know if it's unique in that way, but it's certainly unusual. So I guess generally speaking, you can correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't know that many other areas very well, but I'm guessing more typically that kind of community-led mentoring and support and capacity building would be done by, not by Aberdeenshire Council, by local authority staff through learning and development or whatever. In Aberdeenshire, that was contracted out. So we bid for and get a contract from Aberdeenshire to do that. So Aberdeenshire covers that kind of activity through its economic development department. We mentioned Reed Hutchison as being the officer responsible for that, and instead of employing its own development and support staff, it offers 6 contracts to other organisations who can do that work for it. And those 6 contracts are 6 because they're geographically split. And we bid for and get the one for Banff and Buchan and have done for many years. And so it's again a case of us doing that work instead of the local authority employing its own staff to do it. I think it's quite a cute way of doing it. Aberdeenshire Council thought it up. It wasn't our idea. We just said that sounds like a good contract for us. So I think it probably is, as I said, definitely unusual. I've been told it's unique, but I don't know whether that's true in contracting that kind of work out.
Mm-hmm. And so what type of community organisations are you supporting? What kind of needs are they addressing?
It's quite varied. It would be anything from a small group of people who want to, so for example, somebody that wants to, I'll give you some real examples, that's probably the easiest way of doing it. So one of the groups we're working with is a group of people recovering from substance abuse, or families of people recovering from substance abuse, who've got together to do a self-help group around running a cafe from a community building once a week. And they needed a bit of help to get their, even simple things like constitute as a group, make sure that they understand how to run a simple set of account books, and just basically somebody to be there to say to them, yep, that's the way you do that, or this is who you go and see for that. So very, very basic level mentoring. So that would be at one end of the scale. Another end of the scale would be a large social enterprise like Portsoy Community Enterprise. As they've grown over the years, we've helped them with things that I can remember when they employed their first staff member. And it was a case of what do we need to know in order to become an employer. I can remember when their first staff member went on maternity leave. So how do we do maternity leave then? And so it's business, you know, cash, how to do cash flows, how to look at, as well as information that others supply too, like, you know, potential sources for grant funding or what have you. We're quite involved at the moment with the LEADER programme. The European source grant funding, you know, so we've developed a bit of an expertise in that so that we can give other groups a bit of advice on, well, you know, that might well be a successful LEADER project, or, you know, don't waste your time on that because it's not going to hit the criteria. So it's very much practical hand-holding, mentoring, critical friend, that kind of thing. It's not a very big contract. It's 30 something thousand a year. So, you know, I'm not going to pretend that we put lots and lots of time into it. We put more than 30,000 a year time into it, but that's a conscious decision by ourselves because we think it's a valuable thing to do in our community. And we also do very much believe in the social enterprise model of being a good way for this area. We're not going to get, this is not an area that's suddenly going to get a huge employer that, you know, builds a factory employing 5,000 people. Never going to happen in Banff and Buchan. And the economy is always going to be based around lots and lots of small things. And I actually think there's probably a strength in that. And some of those things are going to be straightforward commercial and not really anything to do with us. The council has its own economic development team to progress that, but the community-led stuff definitely has an important part to play, and we've kind of been there and done it as an organisation, so are reasonably well qualified to pass on knowledge to others. So it's a nice contract for us to have. It's a relatively small contract, but I think it definitely punches above its weight in terms of impact for the area. And all credit to Aberdeenshire Council for seeing that that's a good way of delivering that kind of advice.
And I'm wondering how much you feel part of a kind of national social enterprise network up here. Do you feel that's an important infrastructure that you're part of, or do you very much just see yourself as locally based?
Almost the latter. I think we have an interest in the national scene. So, for example, I always do try and get time in the diary to go to the DTAS conference, because it's terrific to see everything else that's going on in Scotland and wider than Scotland. But I'm not somebody... So there's only so many hours in a day, and I spend most of the hours in my day on my own organisation. I wouldn't say I'm hugely connected into any kind of national scene on any topic, because I just don't really have time. But don't read into that I don't think it's important. It's not the prime thing for me. The prime thing for me is keeping my own organisation, not keeping it going so much as keeping it relevant and delivering the maximum for the local community. But occasionally it is very interesting to go and see what everybody else is doing, and not least because sometimes you pick up good ideas. Truthfully, I probably don't feel like I'm a member of a wider group, but then I've never really tried to join one, so...
and I was wondering there, you've clearly worked quite closely with local authorities, and I'm just wondering how that's changed over time. You set up just in the few years following the change to the unitary local authorities. Have you felt that there's been cutbacks over that last kind of 20 years that you've had to try to fill? Or, do you think that's the kind of relationship you have with local authorities? Or has it been much more about just changing needs in the area that's driven your development?
There's definitely been both. So there's definitely been changes to the area in 20 years, and that's in terms of the employment market in the area. Clearly, there's been changes to the oil industry, there's been changes to the fishing industry, there's been changes to the tourism industry. I suppose really the only one left is farming. There may well have been changes to that too. I'm not that connected to farming. So yes, there's definitely been changes to the area. There's also been a significant change in the way social care is delivered for people with special needs. And we, I suppose fortunately, if you like, we seem to have been the right answer, if you like. So things have changed more in line with what we've always done. I'm not trying to pretend we influence that. There's no question that the local authorities are... so it's principally Aberdeenshire Council we deal with, but we do have some dealings with Moray Council and NHS Highland. But I think Aberdeenshire Council is the... overwhelmingly the principal local authority we deal with. It definitely is much more pressured these days. It doesn't have an enormous impact on us, except that we definitely have to demonstrate to a much higher degree than we used to that what we're doing is actually relevant, good quality, and value for money. I haven't yet come across, once we've demonstrated that, there's still not being money to buy our service. I could foresee that might happen, but I think in a strange way, it's been good for us because we've realised. I mentioned, for example, the dialer bus. We now know that we can't just say, yeah, well, we take a load of folk to Asda. We need to say, well, what difference does that make to their life? And what social outcomes is that producing? And that makes us think a lot about what we do too. I'm not saying I wouldn't like the local authorities to have a lot more money, but we haven't yet found the circumstances where if you have a really good service and you can demonstrate that it's good, but more importantly that it's desperately needed in the area, and it's not a luxury that, you know, they don't need to afford, we've found by and large that you can still make that sale, if you like. I think if you're doing things that are nice to do but not really necessary, it's probably a whole different ball game. But we are doing things that are necessary, and so it's definitely made us sharpen our act up. It's definitely made us be much more questioning about what we're doing and whether we're doing it the best way. So it's challenging, but we haven't found it massively curtailing our business, the fact that the local authorities are so we hear in such a bad financial position. I mean, I've no idea whether they are or not, but you hear it from as many places. I guess they probably are. So I suppose it depends on what you're doing, but I think what we're doing is services that, if they're still the right service for the area and they're delivered properly and at a reasonable cost, we've still been able to make the case that we should get a contract to do them. We've also found it, interestingly enough, not particularly difficult from our straightforward commercial activities, so the, you know, selling lunches in the restaurant or plants in the garden centre or gifts in the gift shop. I think there's no evidence that because times are harder that we've, you know, our trade hasn't gone down or anything like that. But the same there, you need to be, you know, people are much more conscious of value for money these days. Mm.
And do you use any specific tools for that impact measurement that you do? Do you use SROI or social audit and accounting?
This is something we know we need to get much better at, and have already identified as our kind of in-house staff goals. So everything we do up to now is just stuff we made up ourselves, and it's not really probably good enough. And one of the things we've identified is that, so my business is run by a number of department managers, for one, it's not a term we use, but that's probably the most understandable term. So amongst them, and indeed myself, we've all identified that we need to do some work on our own sort of personal development to get more up to speed with how to measure things. So what we've used up to now is just stuff we've devised ourselves, but we're not completely happy with it. We've also looked at one or two models of how to do it, and we haven't really liked them. So it's definitely a work in progress, and something we've identified as being just good for our own self, as well as possibly going to be more of a requirement.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering about the wider kind of policy support for social enterprise that has definitely developed since the turn of the 21st century. Although you've maybe only dipped in and out of that wider social enterprise infrastructure, have you felt the impact of that kind of policy support for social enterprise, you know, around your organisation?
I think the impact, the main impact we've had, we've had a lot of people looking at us and saying that what we're doing is really good and seems to be right. So it's always really nice to know that. I don't think anybody is self-confident enough to not benefit from a bit of praise or approval or whatever the right term might be. A good question would be, would we have changed if people have said we were doing it wrong? I'm not actually convinced we would. But we might. I don't think we've had any direct benefits in terms of, you know, we've won a contract to do something because we're a social enterprise. But there definitely does seem to have been a level of approval of what we do that is helpful in saying that we probably are on the right lines. But I would also just repeat that I am desperately bad at getting involved in things. I am not particularly well connected on things like that. Because kind of truthfully, I just don't have time to be. But I chair the leader program, and that's taken me into contact with Scottish Government officers and so on, and it's been really interesting. And as I said, I like going to things like the DTAS conference, but. I'm trying to think. That's not a question I'd ever really thought of before. But I think really the main difference has been people coming on and saying, "Oh, yeah, you're doing a really great job," and that's always nice to know. We probably haven't really changed anything. As a result of it. It's bad for Bucket, isn't it? I mean, it's the back of beyond. We just do our own stuff. That's why nobody's ever heard of us. And we like it that way. we can get away with things.
You mentioned a wee bit about kind of changes in the people you've been working with over time, you know, in terms of you've got much more young people coming through your door than you
yes,
did
indeed.
In 1999. Yeah. Do you foresee any future changes down the line? Are there any kind of needs that you're picking up on that are coming through?
I think people have much higher level of expectation these days. Now, when I'm saying people, I think that's probably generally true. But so, for example, there's sort of glib quotes you hear, isn't there, about these days everybody expects to own their own home and have two cars in the drive and what have you. That's probably true. I've no way I know whether it is or not. However, if we go more into the context of the people we work with as a charity, so these are young people with a special need, so they no longer... They no longer accept a lack of ambition, if you like. I'm not explaining that very well. So they will want to do more things in their life and achieve more goals in their life, which means that they have to find increasingly they have to find ways round the barriers. So, I'm not going to say her name, but I'm thinking of one young lady in particular. So she wants to be able to fill shelves in the shop and bake cakes in the restaurant and what have you now. She's physically very disabled. She would have a mild learning difficulty too, but principally the barrier to her in life is physical disability. So she has a complex wheelchair that has electric bits bolted onto it that can get her to different heights so that she can do more things. And she expects to be able to do them. So I suppose possibly 20 years ago, maybe not even as long ago as that, she might have attended somewhere where they all sat around a table like the one we're setting up here and did crafts or what have you. That's not going to cut it for this young lady anymore. She wants to be working in a shop and meeting people and all the stuff everybody else wants to do her age. So what she has to do is find ways around the barriers that stop her doing those things. And that's the kind of stuff that we would help her with. We won't have the solutions to all of them, but we might have the solutions to some. So our customers, if you want to call them, our clients, are demanding more of us. There's more things that they want to learn and more things they want to do. And one of the big challenges for my paid staff, as I said, is to look at our business activity and break down every aspect of it into things that people can actually do. So we very much, if you work with people with special needs for long enough, some kind of epiphany happens when you no longer see their disability, what you actually see is their abilities. And that's very much what my staff do, is they're not really interested in the thing the person is never going to be able to do. We look at what they can do and making the most of those. We're no longer going to get away with just everybody coming into this meeting room here and doing crafts for a day. They're going to want a lot more out of life than that. Likewise, at the other end of the scale, with our older people who use the dial bus, they want to still be independent and in their own home. So our services there help them do that. So I think overall, people's expectations are just higher. And that means that we have to be forever developing the quality and breadth of our services. And I wouldn't have it any other way. That's how we stay vibrant as a business. And probably as soon as that stops happening, I probably will retire. But at the moment, there's so many things that we want to do and ideas that we have it's exciting.
That's brilliant. I don't have any more questions for you, Duncan, but is there anything I've missed from your story that you'd like to add?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I do think it's a valid point that as an area, I term it, I'm from Buchan or North East Coast or Murray Coast or whatever, it isn't particularly well connected. There is something in the kind of northeast persona. I mean, I wasn't born here, but I've been here 30 years, so I've kind of developed a northeast persona in not really having a necessity to go out and network particularly. And I don't know that that's always helpful. But it is an area that I think is. So social enterprise doesn't seem like a foreign concept in this area. I think because it's always been quite a self-contained area. For example, if you take the average fishing village, there are loads of people who are used to running their own business because that's what a fishing boat is, and a farm. And so communities being involved in running things doesn't seem like a particularly new or foreign concept here. I can't remember who I was talking to, but I can remember talking to somebody about White Hills Harbour. So White Hills, little fishing village just 3 miles up the road, And if you read the minutes of the meetings of when Whitehills Harbour was built in 1895, it was then and has always been and still is a social enterprise. That's how it was set up. And that was 1895. So I think this is an area where people are used to community-led activity and are not particularly daunted by the concept of having to earn money to do things. And when I go to events like the DTAS conference, it does come as a bit of a surprise when you hear people saying about how trying to sort of raise that way of doing things in an area that they come from. And you don't realise that all areas don't think that way already. So I think it's a good area to be running the kind of activity we're running in. And as I say, it doesn't feel at all alien or different or modern, really. It has, in fairness, had a relatively supportive local authority. I'm not saying Aberdeenshire Council are perfect, far from it, but the kind of thing we're doing, it's not a particularly hard sell to them. They like the idea of it. I'm glad we're doing it here, because certainly when you hear stories of elsewhere, it does seem to have been more difficult to get that concept both within the community and in the local authority. I can't think of anything else. I mean, that's who we are and what we do. We've been doing it a long time, and I imagine we'll be doing it for a bit longer yet too.
Yes, so. Well, I hope so. Yeah, great. Thank you very much.
Good.